From the very outset, the two most dynamic individuals in my office were Frank Klein, my chief assistant DA, and Pershing Gervais, my chief investigator. But the two didn't get along, and Frank Klein issued an ultimatum. Either Gervais went or he would. I had known Gervais since 1941 when we went into the Army together. Gervais had never been involved in investigating the murder of President Kennedy. He was never even a member of the special team. Once we began the Kennedy investigation, the conflict between the two escalated. I knew from talking to Gervais that he was indifferent to the assassination. What I did not know was that since late 66, Gervais had been pressuring Klein to try to get me to stop the Kennedy investigation. Klein, who shared my passion for getting at the truth in the case, resented Gervais' intrusions. Conditioned from my years in the Army, I knew that a commander absolutely never allowed an ultimatum to be issued to him from a lower-ranking officer. I called an attorney named Charles Ward and offered him Klein's position. Within a few days, my sense overcame my pride. I called Frank Klein and suggested that we meet for lunch. I admitted that I had made a mistake and asked him to return to the office. But he refused as long as Gervais was there. Why he did not tell me then about Gervais' pressure to end the Kennedy inquiry, I will never know. What we worked out before we parted was that initially he would keep in touch with me or others in the office through investigator Lou Ivan. And there the lunch ended, curiously enough, with Frank Klein and I as close friends as ever. As for Pershing Gervais, he remained on as chief investigator for the time being. I was his old service buddy, blinded by sentimentality. And I had no idea until it was much too late what his love of money would drive him to. Shortly afterwards, on February 17, 1967, I was jolted again. That was the unforgettable day the New Orleans State's item broke its big story. Although I knew such a story was coming because a reporter had contacted me, the headlines hit me hard. DA launches full JFK death plot probe. Mysterious trips cost large sums. In essence, the story flayed me and the office of the DA for having spent $8,000 on, as it said, unexplained travel and investigative expenses. Immediately following the State's Items articles came a deluge of publicity. Letters of support arrived at the office from all over the world. Public skepticism about the Warren Commission's official story was far deeper and more widespread than I had realized. An unusually strong letter of support came from John Miller, who described himself as an oil man. Soon Miller came down from Denver. Assistant DA Andrew Chambra was present for the meeting. Our visitor wore a well-cut gabardine suit, which had not come off any department store rack. He was a self-assured, impressive man a few years older than I. Miller said to me,
"I suggest that you accept an appointment to the bench in Federal District Court, moving to a job worthy of your talents. You have any idea how easily such an appointment can be arranged? I'm not just saying you can move on to the federal bench. I'm guaranteeing it."
"And what would I have to do to get this judgeship?" With cool aplomb, he said simply,
"Stop your investigation."
For a moment, no one said anything. Then Miller broke the silence.
"The investigation was a magnificent effort, but it's over and done with. Your own local newspaper is already on your behind, and that's only the beginning."
I said, "Mr. Miller, you and I have been under a great misunderstanding. I haven't the remotest interest in becoming a federal judge. And nothing is going to keep me from going ahead with my investigation of John Kennedy's murder." I remained where I was so the man couldn't attempt to shake hands with me. I turned to Andy Chambra. "Andrew, Mr. Miller and I have finished our conversation. Would you mind escorting him to the side door?" When Chambra came back, he said,
"Those bastards! Think they can buy everybody off. Well, they offered you the carrot. You turned it down. You know what's coming next, don't you?"
It was February 22nd, 1967, and the special team, as we had begun to refer to each other, was meeting at my house. Jim Alcock, Andrew Shambra, Dalton Williams, Lou Ivan, and I were having coffee at the round table in the dining room. Because of my own foolishness, Frank Klein, our best mind, was not with us. Nevertheless, it was decision-making time. And the decision staring at us was whether or not the time had come to call David Ferry before the grand jury. To our surprise, Ferry called asking for help. The media had somehow sniffed out that he was one of the targets of our investigation, and they were surrounding his apartment. Ivan told him to wait by the phone. Lou immediately called the Fontainebleau Motel and reserved a first-class suite under an assumed name. He then called Ferry back and told him to go to the Fontainebleau. You did not have to be a psychiatrist to see that Ferry was rapidly deteriorating. His emotional stability seemed so precarious that we could not ignore the situation another day. We discussed the matter at length and decided to hold on a bit longer before calling Ferry to the grand jury. As we were wrapping up our meeting, which had gone on for hours, Louis Ivan was called to the phone. When he returned, he told us,
Dave Ferry's dead. Coroner's already picked up the body at his place.
Two suicide notes were found, one on the table alongside of him, and the second on top of the piano against the wall. The table next to him had a variety of medicine bottles on it, several completely empty, the caps removed. Both suicide notes had been typed, and neither bore Ferry's signature. The first began, quote, To leave this life is for me a sweet prospect. I find nothing in it that is desirable, and on the other hand, everything that is loathsome, end quote. From that point on, the letter became rambling, almost incoherent, as it wandered into a bitter diatribe about the unfairness of life. It made a passing reference to a, quote, messianic district attorney, end quote. The second note, just as bitter, was addressed to a personal friend by name. The unexpected death of David Ferry, along with the two suicide notes, created a frenzy of interest in the media, not merely nationally, but worldwide. Reporters descended upon New Orleans to await the coroner's verdict. I was amazed at this development. Suddenly, newspapers, television, and radio had decided that Ferry's death and the possibility it may have resulted from suicide or foul play may have validated my investigation. When the coroner eventually announced that Ferry had died of natural causes, the excitement of the assembled journalists vanished. It was decision-making time once again. My instincts told me that we had developed a good enough case against Clay Shaw to obtain a grand jury indictment of him for conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy. My instincts also told me that our office had been penetrated by now, although I had no idea to what extent. Consequently, I did not tell anyone on the staff that I felt it was nearly time to make our move against Shaw. We had already questioned Shaw several months back when we established that he was the Clay Bertrand who had called Dean Andrews about representing Lee Oswald. At that time, he had fielded every question flawlessly. No, he had not known Lee Oswald. No, he had never even seen the young man. Did he know a David Ferry? No, the name was unfamiliar to him. He had given us absolutely nothing. On March 1st, 1967, I obtained warrants for Shaw's arrest and the search of his carriage house. I instructed men to arrest Shaw and search his place thoroughly in accordance with the warrants. When Ivan returned to the office with Shaw, I had him taken to one of the senior assistant's offices. We learned that his attorney was Salvador Panzeca, and we contacted him to join his client. An interesting thing occurred during Shaw's booking. Police officer Aloysius Habighorst, in filling out the booking form, routinely asked Shaw whether he had any aliases. Shaw replied, quote, Clay Bertrand, end quote. Habighorst noted this on the form. He had no way of knowing this amounted to a confirmation that Shaw, indeed, had called Dean Andrews to represent Oswald. Among the items seized in the course of Shaw's arrest was his address book. It contained this listing, Lee Odom, P.O. Box 19106, Dallas, Texas. Shaw's attorneys were aware of this entry and in several days produced a man named Lee Odom. He stated that he was in Dallas and that P.O. Box 19106 had never been in his name. It had been used for several months by a barbecue company with which he was once associated. Shaw's attorneys, who now included Edward Wegman as well as Panzeca, picked it up from there. They explained that Odom had once met Clay Shaw to discuss the possibility of promoting a bullfight in New Orleans. The bullfight explanation seemed weak when juxtaposed to the same phrase, PO19106, found on one of the pages of Oswald's address book. The coincidence became even more suspicious when one considered that Lee Oswald had to have written his notation no later than 1963, the year he was murdered. Yet in 63, Dallas had not yet acquired a post office box with a number as high as 19106. With but one exception, Shaw's entire address book consisted of addresses and phone numbers. That one exception appeared on one of the unused pages. There, inscribed in Shaw's handwriting, were the words October and November. Then, after an indecipherable scribble, they were scrawled simply, Dallas. When we arrested Shaw, the United States government awakened like an angry lion. Whoever in my office was the government's contact had been caught napping. There followed roars of outrage from Washington and shrill echoes from the news media. From Ramsey Clark, the Attorney General of the United States, there came the pronouncement that the federal government already had exonerated Shaw from any involvement in President Kennedy's assassination. The statement that Shaw, whose name appears nowhere in the 26 volumes of the Warren Commission, had been investigated by the federal government was intriguing. I wondered, if Shaw had no connection to the assassination, why had he been investigated? The implication of Clark's statement apparently raised similar questions in Washington, and Clark soon beat a strategic retreat. Customarily, I made the presentation to the grand jury. The Shaw case, however, was different. The media had personalized the investigation from the outset. I was presented as a ruthless politician driven by swollen ambition, eager to ride this case to the governor's office or the U.S. Senate. The New York Times even speculated the vice presidency. These stories upset me, not so much because of their absurd portrayals of me, but because they trivialized a serious legal case about the assassination of the President of the United States. The attitude of the media caused me to lean over backwards to establish some personal detachment from the proceedings. Thus, as we sought an indictment of Shaw, I decided not even to enter the grand jury room. I left this to the assistant district attorneys on the special team. They presented the evidence we had uncovered, and the grand jury returned a true bill. Clay Shaw was indicted for participating in a conspiracy to murder John F. Kennedy. Next, I took a step in the defendant's behalf. I made a motion for a preliminary hearing. In major cases, it is customarily the defense attorneys who request a preliminary hearing. The object is to force the district attorney to demonstrate that there is a sound basis for bringing the defendant to trial. Shaw's four-day preliminary hearing began on the morning of March 14, 1967. The large courtroom was filled to overflowing. Reporters and spectators were crowding in everywhere. I would be presenting some of the evidence myself, but I had determined that I was not going to let the media personalize this hearing either. Thus, I had delegated the initial questioning of our first important witness to two of my assistants, Charles Ward, the new chief assistant DA, and Alvin Ozer. At a preliminary hearing, the prosecutor reveals only enough evidence to show that he has a plausible case. At Shaw's hearing, we called only two major witnesses. The first was Perry Russo, a 25-year-old Equitable insurance agent from Baton Rouge, who long had been an acquaintance of David Ferry's. He was present at a meeting at Ferry's apartment when the assassination of President Kennedy had been discussed. Andrew Chambre showed Russo dozens of photographs. Russo recognized several Cubans. And when Chambre produced a picture of Clay Shaw, Russo exclaimed, quote, "I know him. I met him at Ferry's," end quote. Of course, he had known him only as Bertrand, but his identification was positive. Russo was significant because he was the first eyewitness to have overheard Shaw a.k.a. Bertrand, and Ferry discussing the prospective murder of Kennedy. I decided to take the additional precaution of confirming the veracity of Russo's recollection. The lawyers on the special team and I considered using a lie detector test. But since such tests are highly imperfect and inadmissible in court, we rejected the idea. Instead, we chose to use hypnosis and sodium pentothal. Both treatments were administered to Russo under medical supervision, and both revealed that Russo was indeed telling the truth. On the stand, Russo remembered having seen the tall, white-haired man once before, when President Kennedy was in New Orleans for the dedication of the Nashville Street Wharf. Russo had noticed the man because he was the only one not looking at Kennedy. The man had kept studying the crowd, and Russo had concluded that he was a Secret Service agent. Russo recalled that there had been a gathering in September of 63 at Ferry's apartments. The group included a bevy of youngsters that usually surrounded Ferry, some Cubans, and Russo's former girlfriend, Sandra Moffat. Ferry introduced Russo to a young man who was called Leon Oswald. But Russo could not firmly identify this man as the same man he later saw on TV, Lee Harvey Oswald. The talk turned to the possibility of assassinating Fidel Castro. This conversation was speculative and strongly anti-Kennedy. No one present, including Perry Russo, had any use for Castro or President Kennedy. After Russo's girlfriend and the youngsters departed, only Leon Oswald, Bertrand, Ferry, Russo, and several of the Cubans remained. Even if it were impossible to get at Castro, Russo recalled Ferry as saying it did not mean they could not get at Kennedy. This sudden shift of the objectives was inevitable now that the group had grown smaller. Ferry was excited now. Hyperthyroid, he became excited easily, and when he became excited, he became loquacious. All eyes were on him as he continued to describe how easily the job could be done. Ferry said triangulation of crossfire was the way to do it. Shooting at Kennedy from three directions, one of the shots would have to get him. Bertrand said it was important for each of them to be in the public eye when it happened. Ferry responded that he had already decided that he was going to be at Southeastern Louisiana University at Hammond. Bertrand commented that he probably would be traveling on his way to the West Coast. Russo testified that for the first time it struck him that these men were talking about where they were going to be when President Kennedy was killed. There no longer was speculation here. At the conclusion of his testimony, Russo was asked to identify the man he knew as Bertrand. Unhesitatingly, Russo indicated the defendant, Clay Shaw. On cross-examination, Shaw's lawyers spent hours trying to discredit Russo and his testimony. Their efforts failed. The other key witness we called at the preliminary hearing was Vernon Bundy, a black inmate of the New Orleans Parish Prison. In his late 20s, Bundy was a narcotics offender who'd been in jail because of a parole violation. He had told a prison guard that he had information concerning Lee Oswald. When I called Vernon Bundy to the stand, the defense attorneys realized that I was about to have him identify Shaw as meeting with Lee Oswald. They exploded when Bundy admitted that he was a heroin addict and that he'd gone out to Lake Pontchartrain seawall to get a fix. They were on their feet shouting objections, all of which were overruled. Bundy said he had been on the seawall on a July morning in 1963, preparing a heroin injection for himself. He was almost out of view because he was sitting a few steps down towards the water. Bundy testified that at this moment, a black four-door sedan approached and parked. He said the man, whom he described as tall and white-haired, walked about 15 or 20 feet away from him. Bundy said, after 5 or 7 minutes, a young man approached. The two talked for about 15 minutes. The older fella gave the young guy what looked like a roll of money. The young guy stuck it in his back pocket. From photographs, he identified the young man as Lee Oswald, and the man who exited the automobile as Clay Shaw. Now, once again, he picked out the pictures of Lee Oswald and Clay Shaw. He identified them for the judges as the men he'd seen meeting by the seawall. When I asked Bundy to point out the man who had met with Oswald, he pointed straight at the defendant. On cross-examination, the defense lawyers came at Vernon Bundy like wolves. I waited a long time for Shaw's attorneys to wear themselves out against Bundy, and in the end they did. At the conclusion of the preliminary hearing, the three-judge panel ruled that the prosecution had presented sufficient evidence and ordered Clay Shaw to be held for jury trial. On September 4th, Chief Justice Earl Warren announced from Tokyo that I had presented absolutely nothing to contradict the findings of the Warren Commission report. Warren said that he had not heard one fact to refute the commission findings that Lee Oswald was the lone killer. This was strange behavior for the Chief Justice of the United States. Clay Shaw's trial had not begun. The first juror had yet to be selected. Yet here the highest judge in our land was already testifying as the first witness in the case. He was not testifying under oath, which gave him a unique freedom from the laws of perjury. And he was loading the dice in Shaw's favor. No witness was going to be eager to make the Chief Justice appear to be a liar, or at least mistaken. But Warren's wholly inappropriate statement was mild compared to the attacks in the media about our case against Clay Shaw, and on me personally. Ever since Shaw's arrest, the media assault had been vicious and relentless. Without any warning, Dick Billings, the friendly editor from Life magazine, suddenly flew in from New York to inform me that Life would no longer support me in the investigation. He said the magazine had come to the conclusion that I was not the vigorous opponent of organized crime that it had first thought I was. Needless to say, TV journalists also had their day. I'd always been concerned about the size of my staff and budget for an investigation of the JFK assassination. If there were a chance of obtaining an increase in our budget, that had been blown to smithereens by the editorial in the local press and the national onslaught that followed. The dilemma was solved in an unexpected way. Practically out of the blue, volunteers who had heard about the investigation came to help us. Some arrived on the scene personally, some wrote, others called. By the spring of 67, we had acquired an assistant special team made up of the volunteers. The extra help was a great lift to the morale of the special team. Although none of the evidence we had gathered definitively implicated the CIA, I realized that intelligence agencies rarely left smoking guns around. Amazingly, though, leads pointing to the agency continued to come in. This must have worried somebody at Langley because my staff was infiltrated. Over time, I learned that the agency was actually attempting to obstruct our investigation. This only added to my suspicions that the CIA, or some part of it, had been deeply involved in the assassination. The agency's attempted obstruction of our investigation became increasingly perceptible when we tried to extradite Gordon Novel from Ohio. Novel was part of the team that had retrieved CIA munitions from the Schlumberger bunker in Houma, and an informant advised us that Novel had taken a photograph of the truck used in picking up that ammunition. Subsequently, Novel had sold the photograph to Walter Sheridan of NBC. I discussed this unusual case with the DA of Houma. His position was that as far as his jurisdiction was concerned, the removal of the munitions from the Schlumberger bunker had been a burglary. In my judgment, the transport of the burglarized material into New Orleans had been a felony, and the disposal of evidence relating to the offense, the sale of the photograph to NBC, was a crime committed in New Orleans. In the following weeks, Gordon Novel gave interviews and press conferences in Ohio. He began providing the public with more enlightenment about some of the CIA's activities than we had been able to develop in the previous several months. Among other things, he announced that the Schlumberger bunker business had been a CIA enterprise all the way. According to an article in the New Orleans State's Item, Novel had informed acquaintances that he had been a CIA operative. Novel also said that the munitions burglary was no burglary at all, but a war material pickup made at the direction of the CIA. He intended to use this fact to clear himself of charges that he had participated in the burglary of the Schlumberger bunker. Novel identified the other men present at the removal of the munitions from the bunker as all working for the CIA. Among them, David Ferry, Sergio Smith, former head of the Cuban Revolutionary Front in New Orleans, and a number of anti-Castro Cubans whom he did not know. Approximately 1 month later, new evidence indicated more strongly Novel's linkage to the CIA. A few weeks after Novel had departed the New Orleans scene, two young ladies moved into his apartment. While cleaning the apartment, they found a penciled draft of a letter. The note was printed in the state's item. The authenticity of the letter was confirmed by Novel's attorney, Stephen Plotkin, who stated, "Everything in the letter, as far as Novel is concerned, is the truth." Gilbert Fortier, a leading New Orleans handwriting expert, concluded after comparing the letter with other samples of Novel's handwriting that it indeed had been written by Novel. The letter was addressed to Novel's apparent New Orleans CIA contact, a man identified only as Mr. Weiss. It should be added that this letter was written in January 1967, before our investigation had surfaced. In his letter, Novel stated, quote, "I took the liberty of writing you direct to apprise you of the current situation, expecting you'll forward this through appropriate channels. Our connection and activity of that period involves individuals about to be indicted as conspirators in Garrison's investigation. Garrison has subpoenaed myself and an associate to testify before his grand jury on matters which may be classified top secret." End quote. Novel's letter went on to say that the agency should take appropriate counteraction relative to Garrison's inquisition concerning us. He suggested that this could best be handled through military channels vis-a-vis DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency. Here we had Gordon Novel suggesting to the CIA that it have the military assign me to active duty as a way to get me off his back. In the end, I was not called for active duty. Nonetheless, we were unable to extradite Novel from Ohio. This was the first time our office had ever failed in an extradition case. But unfortunately, as we continued to investigate the JFK assassination, it would not be the last. This included an attempt to extradite from Nebraska Perry Russo's ex-girlfriend, Sandra Moffat, who had been at the party at David Ferry's about which Russo had testified. Later, I felt it was time for the grand jury to hear from Alan Dulles. I wanted to know from him whether or not Clay Shaw, Lee Oswald, David Ferry, Gordon Novel, and Guy Bannister had been associated with the CIA, and why his former deputy, General Cabell, had not been questioned by the Warren Commission. I sent off a subpoena. A brisk letter from the U.S. attorney came back shortly. It informed me that he declined to serve the subpoena on Mr. Dulles. Meanwhile, relatives of Richard Case Nagel, a federal intelligence agent, had been in touch with me. They said that in 1963 he had discovered an operation to assassinate President Kennedy. They explained that his attempt to warn the government had resulted in his being sent to the federal penitentiary for 3 years. He was now in New York City following his release from federal prison. Using my own money, I flew to New York to meet with him. In mid-1963, Nagel had been working for the United States government in an agency which he would not identify. The people for whom he worked were curious about a project involving a fellow named Lee Oswald and some other men. Nagel was assigned to spend some time establishing relationships and observing. In late August, it became apparent that an exceedingly large operation pointing toward the assassination of President Kennedy was underway. At this time, the individual who had given Nagel his assignment was moved to another part of the country. Nagel suddenly found himself without a direct contact. It was a strange tale, Nagel being frozen out by the very government agency which had assigned him to conduct a penetration of the ongoing activity. I can only say that Nagel impressed me as being utterly honest and sincere in his account. Knowing what was going to happen, But having no way of knowing when, he decided the best solution was to notify J. Edgar Hoover. He wrote a letter spelling out all that he'd been able to learn about the proposed assassination. When there was no answer from the FBI chief, he concluded that his warning had been in vain. Worse, he sensed from the silence that there was a very real danger of his being drawn into a trap. After all, he had been in the company of Oswald and others with him during much of the summer of 1963. Finally, in what he admitted was an act of desperation, he decided that his one safe course was to ensure that he was in a federal institution on the day the assassination occurred. He would rather be charged, he reasoned, with malicious mischief than be drawn into a giant trap involving assassination. He walked into a federal bank in El Paso, fired several shots in the ceiling, then waited outside, sitting on the curb, until the guard came running by. He had to call back the guard, who in his haste had rushed past him. But Nagel was not charged with malicious mischief. The government charged him with armed robbery. Moreover, at his trial, he was convicted, and the judge sentenced him to 10 years imprisonment. I asked him the names of the other men connected with Oswald. He hesitated, but when the answer came, it was specific. Guy Bannister, Clay Shaw, and David Ferry. Many years down the road, I found myself reading an account of Nagel's arrest by East German police as he attempted to cross back into West Germany. Richard Case Nagel was definitely not your basic vacuum cleaner salesman. Whether Nagel had come to me on his own or had been sent by some intelligence apparatus to set me up in some unknown way, I never learned. But another incident that followed made me realize that I could be entrapped and discredited at any time. I'd just done a speech at New Mexico University. Almost immediately after the talk, Bill Boxley, a former CIA man who'd become one of my volunteer investigators, appeared in the lobby of my motel. I was surprised to see him because I thought he was back in New Orleans. He told me with great concern that an attempt was going to be made to kill me. He felt he had no alternative but to fly to New Mexico, where he could act as my bodyguard. He expressed relief at having made it there in time. I'd always had a high regard for Boxley's intelligence and ability. For once, however, I was furious. I told him, "I don't appreciate your dumping this paranoid garbage on me, especially when it means that I personally am going to end up paying for your flight out here and back." I then left for Los Angeles. There were no seats at the Los Angeles airport baggage claim area, and I hate wasting time. As I'd remarked to Boxley a month or so earlier, it was my habit to go to the men's room, sit down in a toilet booth, and read a magazine until my luggage arrived. This time, something unusual happened. I'd taken the first in a long line of empty booths in the men's room. When someone almost immediately entered the very next booth, I knew that something was wrong. Then I heard low whispering voices at the door. I did not wait a second longer. Since all I had intended to do was read, I was fully dressed. I was thus able to quickly open the door of the booth and leave. Two uniformed airport policemen were stuck momentarily in the exit door of the men's room as they sought to rush out of it simultaneously, apparently in response to my unexpected emergence. The three of us left together. Then I saw a ring of at least half a dozen additional airport police gathered in a semicircle around the entrance to the men's room. Even as it was dawning on me that I had been set up, the sergeant in charge of them addressed me sharply. "Hey, mister, how long were you in that men's room?" As I rushed past the police, I yelled back, "That's none of your goddamn business." As I had a chance to reflect, I realized that there was more to the snare than was visible. I remembered a curious phone call I had received about 3 weeks earlier from Los Angeles. The caller was a man I once represented on a federal case. I recalled him as a furtive and disheveled homosexual who sold pornographic photographs for a living. Such a client was hardly to my choosing, but at the time I was in the business of representing criminal as well as civil cases, so I had accepted his case. But this man failed to pay me, and I notified the court that I was no longer his attorney. Years later, and only 3 weeks before the bizarre incident at the airport, this character had called me out of the blue. After he identified himself, I asked him how he had obtained my unlisted number. He responded vaguely that he had connections. I then asked him why he was calling me, and he launched into a weird explanation. I told him that I had no intention of getting together with him anytime or anywhere, and slammed down the phone. Now I suddenly realized just who had been placed in the booth next to me just prior to my intended arrest at the Los Angeles airport. Had the entrapment worked, the resulting conviction on a sex misdemeanor charge would have made headlines across the nation. The Louisiana legislature would have been left with no alternative but to remove me from office, and the CIA would have accomplished one more dirty trick in the name of national security. It was Boxley who had told the airport police which flight I would be on. He had called them from New Mexico after seeing me get on the plane. The story about an attempt to kill me was concocted. His real mission had been not to protect me, but to set me up. Boxley had been sitting in on our meetings for months. He had been in and out of our file room 100 times. I had to admit that I had been badly fooled. And worse, every one of our files now had to be considered duplicated by the federal government. Nearly 2 years elapsed between Clayshaw's arrest in 1967 and the beginning of his trial. The leads we pursued took us in many directions. The manipulations of evidence by the Warren Commission and the Dallas Homicide Unit in their investigations of the murder of J.D. Tippit were prime examples. Tippit was the Dallas police officer who was shot to death approximately half an hour after the assassination. The murder took place in Oak Park, not too far from where Lee Oswald was boarding at the time. Though the case was never tried, both the Warren Commission and Dallas Homicide agreed that the killer was Lee Oswald. This was a useful conclusion. As one member of the Warren Commission's legal staff rhetorically posed the question and the answer, how do we know that Lee Oswald killed President Kennedy? Because he killed Officer Tippit. Conveniently, the converse also worked. Only a man who had just killed the president and knew he was being hunted down would have any reason to shoot a police officer in a quiet suburb at midday. The only problem with this scenario was that, as so often before, when I examined the evidence, the damning conclusions about Oswald just did not hold up. First of all, given what was known about Oswald's movements, it was highly improbable that he could have been physically present at the time of Tippett's murder. According to several eyewitnesses at the scene, Tippit was shot anywhere from 1:06 p.m. to 1:10 p.m. Yet Oswald had returned to his rooming house at around 1 p.m. He left quickly, and Earlene Roberts, the housekeeper, observed him standing by the northbound Beckley Avenue bus stop at 1:04. The area where Tippit was killed was in the opposite direction, a mile to the south. Using the broadest interpretation of the time element, even if Oswald had changed his mind about the bus and run southward, it was virtually impossible for him to have arrived at the scene before the shooting of the police officer. The Warren Commission simply ignored these time anomalies and presented various eyewitnesses whose testimony quickly fell apart. Domingo Benavides had been the closest of all the witnesses to the shooting, a few yards. He would not identify Oswald as having been there. Mark Lane, the critic who later came to New Orleans to work with our investigation, had tracked down and interviewed a witness, Akilah Clemens. Before the first shot, she observed two men standing near Officer Tippett's police car. She saw one of the men with the pistol, waving away the other as he trotted toward Jefferson Street on the far side of the block. The running man, who she saw shoot the police officer, was, in her words, kind of short, kind of heavy. The second man was tall and thin, wearing a white shirt and khaki slacks, clothing which no other witnesses recalled Oswald wearing that day. Clemens said Dallas police officers told her not to tell anyone what she had seen, lest she be killed. A familiar piece of law enforcement advice in Dallas that day. Beyond the eyewitnesses, there was other evidence gathered and altered by the Dallas Homicide Unit showing that Lee Oswald had been framed in the Tippit murder. For instance, I read transcripts of messages sent over the Dallas police radio shortly after the murder. Just minutes after a citizen first reported the murder on Tippit's own radio, Patrolman H.W. Summers reported that an, quote, eyeball witness to the getaway man, unquote, had been located. The suspect was described as having black wavy hair, wearing an Eisenhower jacket of light color, with dark trousers and a white shirt. He was apparently armed with a .32, dark finish, automatic pistol, which he had in his right hand. Moments later, Sergeant G. Hill reported that, quote, the shell at the scene indicates that the suspect is armed with an automatic .38 rather than a pistol, end quote. Automatic weapons leave a marking on the shells when being ejected from the gun upon firing. It seemed clear to me from this that the handgun used to shoot Tippit was an automatic. But the gun allegedly taken from Lee Oswald when Dallas police later arrested him at the Texas Theater was a revolver. The bullets found in Officer Tippett's body and the cartridges found at the scene of his murder yielded further evidence of the frame-up. The Dallas coroner had conducted an autopsy on Tippett's body and had removed four bullets from it. Three of them, it turned out, were copper-coated and had been manufactured by Winchester. The fourth, however, was a lead bullet made by Remington. The discovery of two different makes of bullets in Tippett's body indicated to me, as it would indicate to most experienced police officers, a likelihood that two different gunmen did the shooting. This was consistent with the eyewitness testimony of Akilah Clemens and others. It seemed clear to me what had happened. Dallas Homicide failed to get a positive ID with Oswald's revolver from the bullet. So they were not about to send off to Washington cartridges with automatic ejector marks on them, even if these were the actual cartridges found at the scene. Instead, someone in the homicide division or cooperating with it had fired Oswald's confiscated revolver after his arrest. Thus were obtained the needed cartridges to forward to the FBI lab. However, competence was not the Dallas Homicide Unit's strong suit, even when fabricating evidence. The FBI lab found that two of the cartridge cases had been manufactured by Western and two by Remington. Since the lab had already concluded that three of the bullets found in Tippett's body were copper-coated Westerns and one was a lead Remington, these numbers simply did not add up. The fact that so many suspects in and around Dealey Plaza had been allowed to go free by the Dallas authorities interested me a great deal. If those suspects had been properly detained and questioned, I felt, one of them might well have led authorities to the planners behind the assassination. At the time I was looking into the matter of the escaped suspects, a computer consultant from New York named Richard E. Sprague contacted me. Sprague had collected and studied extensively many of the approximately 500 still photographs and motion pictures taken at Dealey Plaza on the day of the assassination. He was particularly excited about several photos that showed three men arrested in the railroad yard being marched away by police. Sprague had traced the flight of these three men to the empty boxcar in the railroad yard. They were the tramps and hobos described by Sergeant D.V. Harkness. They had been taken from a boxcar just as the freight train was starting to pull out of the railroad yard. According to Harkness, the three suspects were, quote, taken down to the station and questioned, end quote. Yet no record of these suspects existed. No names, no mugshots, no fingerprints, no nitrate tests. Somewhere along the line, they too had been set free by Dallas authorities. If either the tramps in the photos or the officers escorting them could be identified, new avenues for investigation would be opened. Several details of the photos raised questions. For example, the arrested men were not handcuffed. This was strange. For offenses much less serious than murdering a president, police officers routinely handcuffed their prisoners every day. Certainly, if these men were dangerous enough to be marched away under shotgun guard, they were dangerous enough to be handcuffed as well. And there was something interesting about the police officer marching in the front, the apparent leader of the arresting officers. A tall, lean man, he was wearing a miniature radio receiver ear clip, a plastic device less than half an inch by a quarter of an inch in size. In 1963, most intelligence agencies possessed these devices. But I knew of no local police force that did. All of these details together made me wonder if the shabbily dressed suspects were actually tramps, and were the uniformed men with the shotguns actually Dallas police officers. Some of the best witnesses to the assassination found their way to us after it became apparent to them that the federal agents and the Dallas police really were not interested in what they saw. Julia Ann Mercer was just such a witness. In fact, no other witness so completely illuminated for me the extent of the cover-up. Mercer had been but a few feet away when one of the riflemen was unloaded at the grassy knoll shortly before the arrival of the presidential motorcade. Consequently, she was a witness not only to the preparation of President Kennedy's murder, but also to the conspiracy involved. She gave statements to the FBI and the Dallas Sheriff's Office, but she was never called by the Warren Commission, not even to provide an affidavit. When I showed her copies of her statements as they had been printed in the Warren Commission exhibits, her response was, quote, "These all have been altered. They have me saying just the opposite of what I really told them," end quote. At the FBI office, where she went the day after the assassination, she was shown a number of mugshots. Among the several she selected as resembling the driver was a photograph of Jack Ruby. On Sunday, when she saw Ruby kill Oswald on television, she positively recognized him as the driver of the pickup truck and promptly notified the local bureau office. Nevertheless, the FBI altered her statement so that it did not say that she had made a positive identification. She said, quote, "He was only a few feet away from me. How could I not recognize Jack Ruby when I saw him shoot Oswald on television?" End quote. The Dallas Sheriff's Office went through the same laborious fraud. The Sheriff's Office filed a sworn affidavit stating that she did not identify the driver. Of the notarized copy, Mercer said, quote, "That's not my signature either. I signed my name with a big A like this," end quote. She produced a pen and wrote her name for me. It was clear that the signature the Dallas Sheriff's Office had on its altered statement was not even close to hers. Julia Ann Mercer then wrote on the side of my copies of the FBI and the Dallas Sheriff fabrications the correct version of what she had seen then. Another citizen who volunteered information was William S. Walter, a former FBI employee, and his information was vital to our investigation. On November 17th, 1963, 5 days before the assassination, he had been the night clerk on duty at the FBI's New Orleans office. At 1:45 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, a message came over the teletype machine warning about a possible presidential assassination attempt. Walter immediately called 5 agents who handled the relevant local units and considered his duty done. The telex had been sent out over the name of the director himself, J. Edgar Hoover. Here's what the message said. "Urgent. 2. All special agents. From. Director. Information has been received by the Bureau. Bureau has determined that a militant revolutionary group may attempt to assassinate President Kennedy on his proposed trip to Dallas, Texas, November 22-23, 1963. All receiving offices should immediately contact all local race and hate group informants and determine if there is any basis for threat. Bureau should be kept advised of all developments by teletype. Other officers have been advised. End and acknowledge, please. We learned from Walter that when the assassination occurred, he immediately went to the files where he found the warning telex along with a duplicate. At that time, he copied the exact phraseology of the telex warning and kept it. Shortly afterwards, he checked the file again to see if the warning was still there, but it had been removed. Had the November 17th warning been distributed to all concerned agencies, the last-minute change in the parade route could have been spotted as a trap. Also, the limousine's plastic bubble, which might have saved the president, could have been used. And the rules of keeping windows closed and rooftops empty along the motorcade route could have been enforced by the Secret Service. Instead, as the parade approached the book depository on the substituted route, the proliferation of open windows and the open limousine left no doubt that security for President Kennedy had been abandoned. The Secret Service's performance was less than exemplary in other ways. Before the day was over, the Secret Service cleaned out the president's limousine, washing away bullet fragments with buckets of water. Governor John Connally's clothing, bullet holes, bullet traces, and all was sent to be cleaned and pressed. Preservation of important evidence was clearly not high on the Secret Service's agenda. When I learned of the telex warning from William Walter, nearly 5 years had passed since the assassination. But in that time, none of the five agents Walter had called ever hinted to the American people or to the Warren Commission that the FBI had received a specific warning about the assassination 5 days before it occurred. Nor had any of the special agents in charge across the country to whom the warning had been addressed. If such conspicuous silence did not smell of cover-up, I did not know what did. Later, after Walter got to know me better, he told me that during our investigation of the assassination, the Bureau recorded all my home telephone conversations. The 5-day warning telex soon took on added significance. I learned belatedly of some remarkable information made public years before by C.A. Hamblin, the early night manager of Western Union's Dallas office. A week following the assassination, Hamblin told a number of people that 10 days before the assassination, Lee Oswald had been in his Western Union office. He had sent a telegram to Washington, D.C. It was Hamblin's impression that Oswald's telegram had been directed to the Secretary of the Navy. Hamblin also recalled that on several occasions, Oswald had come to his Western Union office to collect modest money orders which had been sent to him. According to Hamblin, for identification, Oswald showed him a library card and a Navy ID card. This was very close to what Oswald routinely carried for identification, a library card and Marine ID card. With Hamblin's recollection, an intriguing situation arose. About 10 days before the assassination, Lee Oswald had sent a telegram to the Secretary of the Navy. Then 5 days before the assassination, FBI headquarters had sent a detailed telex warning of the impending attempt to kill the president. Were the two messages somehow related? My earlier research about Oswald's relationship to the FBI seemed relevant to this question. I'd learned long before that Oswald's address book contained the name of FBI agent James Hostie of the Dallas Bureau office. Immediately following Hostie's name, Oswald had written a telephone number, Hostie's unlisted home number or some message center. Then, years after the Warren Commission inquiry, an item appeared in the press describing Oswald's visit to the Dallas FBI office shortly before the assassination. The news story said that Oswald had left a note addressed to Agent Hostie. What the note actually said will never be known for sure. Hostie claims that he was ordered to destroy it. In any event, I began to wonder if Lee Oswald was a confidential informant for the FBI, reporting to Special Agent James Hostie. This possibility had been raised early in 1964 by Wagoner Carr, then Attorney General of Texas. Carr told the Warren Commission he had evidence that indicated Lee Oswald had been an FBI undercover informant. Carr's evidence came from Alan Sweat, the chief of the criminal division of the Dallas Sheriff's Office. More specifically, Oswald had been employed by the FBI as confidential agent number 179 at a salary of $200 a month. His employment began more than a year prior to and continuing up to the very day of the murder of President Kennedy. This shocking news leaked into the media. After considerable debate, the Warren Commission agreed that it was necessary to conduct thorough hearings on this matter. Unfortunately, no such hearings were held. The confidential informant idea began to make sense to me. It could explain the presence of Hostie's name and unlisted number in Oswald's address book. And it would be the reason for Oswald's visit to the Dallas Bureau office and his note to Hostie. And the confidential informant possibility threw a most intriguing light on another curious fact. The FBI did not mention Lee Oswald as a suspect in the assassination until 2.5 hours after the shooting. If Oswald was on the government payroll in Dallas and New Orleans, he might well have believed that his job was to penetrate subversive organizations. That would include Fair Play for Cuba and perhaps Guy Bannister's apparatus in order to report back to the FBI about them. Along the way, he was allowed to penetrate a marginal part of the assassination project. But it was equally possible that Oswald had been acting as an informant for some other branch of intelligence. But which government payroll had he been on? If that other branch was ONI, that would explain Oswald sending a telegram to the Secretary of the Navy from Hamlin's Western Union office. And it would explain Oswald using a Navy ID card for identification instead of his usual use of a Marine ID. Could he have been warning the Secretary and ONI of the impending assassination that he had penetrated? And if so, was he withholding relevant information about the conspiracy from Hostie and the FBI? It was impossible to know what was in Lee Harvey Oswald's mind. But whatever he thought he was doing, he had clearly acquired more information than the assassination's engineers could tolerate. And that is why he had to die so suddenly in Dallas, less than 72 hours after John Kennedy. I knew I could never take any of this into the courtroom. It offered no real link to Clay Shaw, and it was only conjecture. The question that troubled me, and may well have troubled Oswald, was if the Dallas police, the sheriff's office, the Secret Service, the FBI, and the CIA were all potentially involved in the plot, who were the proper authorities? It had been a long and frustrating uphill fight by the time we finally got Clay Shaw to trial in criminal district court. And in the meantime, our office had been thoroughly infiltrated by the federal government. And Bill Boxley had stolen many of our files. As if that were not enough, a week or two before the trial began, Lou Ivan learned that a young Englishman from Oxford who was in charge of our archives had given copies of many of our files to the defense. Almost as important, some of our key witnesses, David Ferry, Gordon Novel, Sandra Moffat, had died or been scared off or moved from New Orleans with no chance of my extraditing them. Jim Alcock would be chief prosecutor for the trial. A special team arranged the order of witnesses' appearance and how we would handle them. One witness, an accountant from New York named Charles Spiesel, came to us very late in our investigation and presented us with a dilemma. He claimed to have met Ferry and Shaw on a trip to New Orleans and heard them discussing the possible assassination of the president. Alcock brought me a statement and asked what I thought about using him. By this time, I'd become quite suspicious because of all the tricks already played on us. While I could find nothing specifically wrong with the statement, told Alcock I found it simply too pat. But Alcock decided he wanted to call Spiesel. And since I did not have time to interview the witness myself, I agreed. It was a decision we would soon come to regret. On January 29, 1969, the case of State of Louisiana versus Clay Shaw finally came to trial. Judge Edward Haggerty presiding. Following the opening statements, we called as our first witnesses the citizens of the small town of Clinton, Louisiana, who had seen Lee Oswald there in the company of Clay Shaw and David Ferry 2 months before the assassination. Andrew Chambra handled their questioning. Reeves Morgan, a former state legislator, testified that after the assassination, he notified the FBI of Oswald's presence in Clinton. Morgan said that the special agent thanked him, but told him that the FBI already knew about Oswald's visit. He heard nothing further from the Bureau. John Manchester, the Clinton town marshal, testified that he checked out all strange cars visiting Clinton. He said, quote, "I walked over and talked to the man behind the wheel of the car. He was a big man, gray hair, ruddy complexion. Said he was representative of the International Trademark New Orleans," end quote. Manchester pointed to Clay Shaw as the man he had questioned. Manchester also contacted the state police and confirmed that the limousine was the property of the International Trademark in New Orleans. The Clinton witnesses also identified photographs of David Ferry as the man who had been sitting next to him. During the questioning, I glanced over at Clay Shaw. Next to him sat his chief counsel, Irvin Diamond. Also present at the defense table were Edward and William Wegman. Another apparent member of Shaw's defense team was an attorney named Richard Matthews. He was not a counsel of record and was not at the defense table, but every day he sat in the first row of spectators directly behind Shaw. And from time to time he would exchange whispers with the defendant. From conversations I had previously had with Matthews, I got the feeling he was with the CIA. Somebody on Shaw's side had to be representing the intelligence community. Matthews disappeared immediately after the trial. However, years later, my assumption that the CIA had been aiding Shaw's defense was proved to be quite true. At the time of our investigation, Victor Marchetti was a high-ranking staff employee at CIA headquarters. In an article published in True Magazine, Marchetti referred to the agency's concern during the Shaw trial. Quote, "At the director's morning meeting, I remember Richard Helms on several occasions asking questions like, 'Are we giving them all the help they need?' This was a reference to Shaw's defense team. I knew they didn't like Garrison because there were a lot of snotty remarks passed about him. So at the time I said, 'What's the concern about this trial and this guy Shaw?' I was then told Shaw had been a contact of the agency. He was in the export-import business. He knew people coming and going from certain areas, the domestic contact service. He used to deal with them. It's been cut off a long time ago, and then I was told the agency doesn't want this to come out now because Garrison will distort it, and the public would misconstrue it." End quote. Of course, at the time, we had no proof of Shaw's connections to the agency, nor did we know the extent of the agency's help for him. We proceeded at the trial as if we had a fair chance for a conviction. In order to show the relationship between Shaw and Oswald, we called Vernon Bundy to the stand. Bundy had testified in the preliminary hearing that he had observed Lee Oswald and Clay Shaw meeting together out on the seawall along Lake Pontchartrain. Bundy repeated in detail the story he had told at the hearing. This time, however, Bundy added a piece of unexpected drama. Without any warning, he asked the judge to allow him to demonstrate how he knew it was Clay Shaw who was at the lakefront. He asked, "Would you have the gentleman there go to the back of the courtroom?" After a surprised moment of hesitation, the judge nodded his assent. Shaw complied, with bailiffs on each side of him. Bundy stepped down from the witness chair. He turned Shaw's chair around and sat in it sideways, looking toward the entrance of the court where Shaw was. Then Bundy said, "Would the gentleman approach me?" Shaw and the bailiffs moved forward. Bundy explained, "I was sitting there on top of the seawall." Now Bundy was watching the way Shaw's foot twisted when he walked. He said, "The limp. That's how I identified this man the next time I saw him." Everyone in the courtroom was able to observe Shaw had a slight limp. He later explained it was from a back injury received in the Army. Afterwards, it was plain that courtroom jurors had been impressed with Vernon Bundy's testimony. It certainly was the first time I ever saw a witness take over the courtroom during a trial. And until that day, I had no idea Shaw walked with a limp. By now, we had established the relationship among Shaw, Oswald, and Ferry. And we had established that Shaw gave money to Oswald in a clandestine setting. We should have known that things were going too well. The bomb that shattered our case exploded quickly enough. His name was Charles Spiezel. The accountant from New York, whom we had belatedly added to our witness list, took the stand next. He said that on a trip to New Orleans, he met David Ferry in the French Quarter, and later they joined Clay Shaw. After some heavy drinking, Spiezel said Ferry and Shaw began discussing the possible assassination of John Kennedy. He recalled Shaw and Ferry each explaining why Kennedy should be eliminated and how it should be done. On cross-examination, the chief defense counsel seemed to know just what questions to ask Spiezel. First, Diamond asked if Spiezel had ever publicly complained about hypnosis and psychological warfare being used on him. Spiezel replied that he indeed had been hypnotized in various places between 1948 and 1954. Asked who hypnotized him, Spiezel said he did not always know. He said, "You could tell that hypnosis was being tried when someone tries to get your attention, catch your eye. That's a clue right off." Diamond then asked him what happened under hypnosis. Spiezel replied, "They plant certain thoughts in your mind and you are given the illusion that they are true." Under further cross-examination, Diamond brought out Spiezel's belief that the New York City police had hypnotized him, tortured him mentally, and forced him to give up his practice as an accountant. Then Diamond zeroed in for the kill. "Was it not a fact," he asked, "that when Spiezel's daughter left New York to go to school at Louisiana State University, he customarily fingerprinted her?" Spiezel replied in the affirmative. Diamond then asked if it were not also a fact that he customarily fingerprinted his daughter again when she returned at the end of the semester. Again, the witness said yes. Diamond then asked why he fingerprinted her. Spiezel explained that he did this in effect to make sure that the daughter who was returning from LSU was the same one he had sent there. For one very long moment, I was swept with nausea. I realized just how cynical and subtle the clandestine operation of the opposition was. Our only hope now was that our subsequent witnesses could drown out the memory of Spiezel. So next we called Perry Russo, perhaps our most important witness. Russo largely repeated the testimony he had given in a preliminary hearing. He reiterated being at Ferry's apartment numerous times. To the very end, Russo remained unshaken. In his clear-minded insistence that he had seen Clay Shaw and David Ferry meeting with the young man named Leon Oswald, and he was adamant that they had discussed in detail the assassination of the president. Next, we had to establish that the president had to have been shot by more than one gunman, and that there had to have been a conspiracy. So we called a number of witnesses from Dallas who saw and heard shooting from in front of the motorcade. William E. Newman, a young design engineer from Dallas, described how he had been only 10 to 15 feet away from the limousine when he saw the first shot hit the president in the front of the head. He testified that Kennedy fell backwards violently. Newman said the shots were coming from the grassy knoll right behind where he was standing. His testimony was corroborated by Frances Newman, his wife, and by James Simmons, an employee of the Union Terminal Railway, and by Mrs. Mary Moorman, a housewife from Dallas, and Mrs. Philip Willis. Richard Randolph Carr testified that he had heard shots from the grassy knoll and had seen a furrow caused by a bullet that missed the president's limousine, cutting a path through the grass in Dealey Plaza. Carr then saw four men running out of the book depository. One walked away, but the other three climbed into a Nash Rambler on Houston Street and drove off. When he told his story to the FBI, Carr testified, the agents told him to keep his mouth shut. Deputy Sheriff Roger Craig corroborated some of Carr's testimony. He had seen a Nash Rambler driven by a Latin man pull up on Elm Street in front of the depository. There it picked up a young man, whom he later took to be Lee Oswald, before speeding away. The expert witness we called to demystify the Warren Commission's official explanation of the president's bullet wounds was Dr. John Nichols. He was an associate professor of pathology at the University of Kansas who had studied the Zapruder film. To help the jury understand Dr. Nichols' testimony, we had subpoenaed the Zapruder film and other pictures. This was the first time in more than 5 years that this film had truly been made public. Up until then, it had been kept in the vaults of Life magazine. To be sure, the FBI had given a copy of the Zapruder film to the Warren Commission. But for that hearing, two critical frames had been mysteriously reversed. In photographic terms, that's called flopping the picture, taking a negative and flipping it over before printing it. That reversal created the false impression that a rifle shot to Kennedy's head had been fired from behind. After a routine examination, even the Warren Commission was forced to recognize the reversed frames. It asked the FBI what happened. Hoover explained that an inadvertent printing error had occurred. Dr. Nichols testified, "Having viewed the slides, pictures, and the Zapruder film, I find that it is compatible with the gunshot having been delivered from the front." Dr. Nichols further testified that the president had been shot not only from the front, but also from behind. In lay terms, Dr. Nichols described how the bullets from behind had entered Kennedy's body from divergent angles. That meant the riflemen had to be firing from two different positions. We hoped that Dr. Nichols' testimony would clarify for the jury the utter impossibility of the Warren Commission's official story. It had said that 7 entry and exit wounds in President Kennedy and Governor Connally were caused by 1 bullet. The Zapruder film established a maximum time frame for the shooting of 5.6 seconds. In such a short time, a lone assassin could have fired only 3 bullets. After that, the government adopted an official posture which came to be known as the magic bullet theory. 1 bullet missed completely. A fragment struck onlooker James Teague in the cheek. A 2nd bullet hit the president in the head and shattered his skull. That left a 3rd magic bullet to account for the remaining 7 wounds in Kennedy and Connally. According to the government's account, the 7 wounds were inflicted as follows. The bullet entered the president's back or neck and headed downward at an angle of 17 degrees. It then moved upward and departed from Kennedy's body out of the front of his neck. Then it continued into Connally's body at the rear of his right armpit. Now the bullet headed downward at 27 degrees, shattering Connally's 5th rib and departing from the right side of his chest. The bullet continued downward and then entered Connally's right wrist, shattering the radius bone. After coming out of the other side of the governor's right wrist, it entered his left thigh, from which it later fell out. According to the official story, this bullet was later found in almost perfect condition in a corridor of Parkland Hospital, apparently having fallen from a cot. The bullet was nearly flawless, deformed slightly only at its base. Curiously, more bullet fragments were found in Governor Connally's wrist than were found to be missing from the bullet itself. It is also of some interest that Jack Ruby had been seen in the halls of Parkland Hospital shortly before the magic bullet was found. Some critics have speculated that Ruby may have delivered it to the hospital. We wanted Dr. Nichols to point out to the jurors that such an explanation defied the laws of physics, not to mention common sense. Yet that scenario was central to the government's lone assassin theory. Once the jury accepted that the magic bullet could not have created all seven different wounds, it would then have to conclude that there was a second rifleman, and thus a conspiracy. The linkage depended largely on the fact that the roly-poly hippie attorney, Dean Andrews, had admitted receiving a call from Clay Bertrand about representing Lee Oswald in Dallas, and that Clay Bertrand was actually Clay Shaw. So we called as our next witness Mrs. Jessie Parker, a hostess at the VIP room of the New Orleans airport. She testified that in December 66, she saw Clay Shaw sign the room's guest register as Clay Bertrand. In the courtroom, Parker then pointed to Shaw as the man who signed it. Shaw's attorneys led off with a mandatory series of character witnesses. The first of the defense's two important witnesses was Lieutenant Colonel Pierre Fink. He was one of the three pathologists who participated in the military autopsy of President Kennedy at Bethesda Naval Hospital. Fink testified that the autopsy strongly supported the likelihood that the president had been killed by one rifleman firing at him from behind. One shot hit him in the neck, and the other struck him in the back of the head and killed him. Alvin Ozer cross-examined Fink. He questioned whether the neck wound had been probed at the autopsy. This should have been standard routine to determine the route of the wound. When Dr. Fink's answer was negative, Ozer began pressing him. Mr. Ozer, was Dr. Humes running the show in the autopsy room? Dr. Fink, I heard Dr. Humes asking, "Who's in charge here?" And I heard an Army general stating, "I am." You must understand that in those circumstances, there were law enforcement officers, military people with various ranks, and you have to coordinate the operation according to directions. Mr. Ozer, was this Army general a qualified pathologist? Dr. Fink, no. Mr. Ozer, was he a doctor? Dr. Fink, no, not to my knowledge. Mr. Ozer, how many other military personnel were present at the autopsy room? Dr. Fink, the autopsy room was quite crowded with military and civilian personnel and federal agents, Secret Service agents, and FBI agents. Mr. Ozer, did you feel you had to take orders from this Army general? Dr. Fink, no, because there were admirals present also. At the end of the autopsy, we were specifically told by Admiral Kinney, the surgeon of the Navy, that the autopsy was subject to verification, and then we were specifically told not to discuss the case. Mr. Ozer, did you dissect the track of that particular bullet in the victim? Dr. Fink, no, we didn't remove the organs of the neck for dissection. Mr. Ozer, why? Dr. Fink, I was told not to, but I don't remember by whom. We were quite surprised to learn that an Army general had ordered the autopsy pathologists not to do the neck probe, and that an admiral had ordered them not to discuss the autopsy. Even more shocking to me was the next major witness for the defense, Clay Shaw. He took the stand and testified under oath that he had never known Oswald, never used the alias Clay Bertrand, and never called Dean Andrews. And most amazing of all, he testified that he had never even met David Ferry. In the normal course of events, that would have put Shaw up for future perjury prosecution. But this case was hardly normal, and it was clear by now that no jury would find an eminently respectable, prominent, distinguished community leader guilty of conspiring to kill the president, especially following an unforgettable example of genuine lunatic testimony from a prosecution witness. Just past midnight on March 1st, 1969, the jury filed into the courtroom and announced that it had acquitted Clay Shaw. Had the jurors been aware of Shaw's agency connection, the verdict might possibly have been different. even as it was, every juror polled after the verdict agreed that the prosecution had established that President Kennedy had been killed as the result of a conspiracy. To me, this was important. The jurors had acquitted Shaw as an individual, but they had not accepted the federal government's great lie about the assassination. As one might expect, the local newspaper editorials following the acquittal vociferously called for my resignation. The electorate responded to that call, and I was later defeated for re-election as district attorney. On June 30, 1971, I was arrested by federal agents. I stood accused of participating in organized crime, specifically allowing of payoffs on pinball gambling. The plain fact was that I enforced the law forbidding payoffs on pinball gambling more rigidly than any previous DA had. The federal government apparently had not realized this, assuming that all Louisiana DAs kept one eye closed on pinball payoffs. The 26 months between my arrest and my trial were filled with playing catch-up on the endless overload of office work. The centerpiece of the government's case turned out to be my old army buddy, Pershing Gervais, my special investigator. I dropped Gervais from the office staff after an attorney informed me that Gervais had offered to get a case dismissed for him for $750. After his dismissal, Gervais' income was underwritten by scams involving influence peddling. IRS agents caught him and turned him. Once government officials learned about $5,000 I had loaned him, they wired Gervais and directed him to have conversations with me. They hoped that the tape-recorded information would prove incriminating. Obviously, I had conversations with Gervais each time he visited me to supposedly repay my loan in dribs and drabs. These now-taped conversations were spliced into bogus, yet incriminating, evidence against me. The highlight of the government's prosecution was its doctored tapes. Pinball owners, one after another, testified they had never had any dealings with me nor experienced any favors from me or from anyone in my office. Even the former police commander of the vice squad testified that I had never asked him to do anything improper. He testified further that my office never had any prior knowledge of pinball raids and that we had a high percentage of convictions in pinball cases. Pershing Gervais and his family had been sequestered in Canada in the government's witness relocation program. He had been given a job with General Motors, and all he had to do was show up several times a week to collect his $22,000 a year. But Gervais rebelled against the Justice Department's confinements, and in May of 72, he gave an interview in Canada to reporter Rosemary James for a New Orleans television station. I had obtained a copy of the transcript, and during my trial, portions of that interview were read aloud. Were you forced to work for the government? More than that, I was forced to lie for them. That's a better description. What were you forced to do? It became clear that they were really interested in but one man, Jim Garrison. And in their minds, they knew that I was the guy who could get him. Are you saying you got him? Oh, yeah, no question about that. Did the government want to investigate people in the pinball industry and Jim Garrison? They wanted Garrison. Their primary objective was to silence Jim Garrison. Are you saying that you participated in a deliberate frame-up? Absolutely. A total, complete political frame-up. What you are saying explicitly is that the government's entire case against Jim Garrison is a fraud? No question about it. Anything founded and based purely on politics can't be anything but fraud. It's a lie? The entire thing. In court, he admitted that these were the replies he had made when interviewed. At that point, of course, the government's case against me swirled down the drain into the sewer, where it had belonged all along. But I was not yet through. Now I wanted to reveal the worthlessness of the fraudulently altered tape recordings once and for all. I did, with the help of an expert, Dr. Louis Gerstmann, a professor of speech and hearing science at the City University of New York. Dr. Gerstmann's testimony was to the point. He had found the government's prior evidence to be a fabrication of prior tapes that had been spliced together. The government's case collapsed ignominiously. I and my two co-defendants were found not guilty. There is a minor postscript to this government sham. Later on, I was brought to trial a second time for evading income taxes. The government's position was that I had not paid taxes on the monies I was supposed to have received from pinball operators for looking the other way. It was proven in my first trial that I had never taken any bribes. Hence, the income they were looking for simply wasn't there. Obviously, I wasn't going to pay taxes on income which was non-existent. The government's case against me was dismissed. Much has happened since Clayshaw's trial and my trial. Important characters in my investigation, like the virulent anti-communist Guy Bannister and his private detective associate Jack Martin, have gone unnoticed to their graves. Others have died in undeniably mysterious circumstances. Lee Oswald Dallas' friend and babysitter, Baron George de Morenschildt, was found shot to death. That was just hours after arranging to be interviewed by an investigator from the House Select Committee on Assassinations. David Ferry was discovered dead in his New Orleans apartment with two unsigned suicide notes by his side. Deputy Sheriff Roger Craig left Dallas and moved to New Orleans as the result of an attempt on his life. He grew homesick for Dallas, however, and moved back. His car was blown up while he was in it, but he survived. Then he was found shot to death at his home. The coroner's verdict was suicide. Jack Ruby, having been treated at the Dallas Sheriff's Office for a cold, was sent to the hospital where it got worse. Shortly thereafter, it was announced that he had died from cancer. Lee Harvey Oswald, of course, was shot by Ruby in front of a television audience of millions and a virtual wall of Dallas police officers. Ruby's stated reason for killing Oswald was to save Mrs. Kennedy the burden of having to attend Oswald's trial. That's questionable, particularly in view of Ruby's ties to organized crime, the FBI, and the CIA. Clayshaw died on August 14, 1974, and the circumstances were also odd. One day, a neighbor of Shaw saw some men carrying a body on a stretcher in the front door of Shaw's carriage house. The entire body was covered with a sheet. After a day of inquiry, the Orleans Parish coroner's investigators learned that Shaw had just been buried in a cemetery in the parish where he was born. As for myself, I spent 4 years in private law practice, wrote a novel, and then was elected to office as a judge on the Louisiana Fourth Circuit Court of Appeal. In 78 and 79, the House Select Committee on Assassinations conducted its hearings. It stumbled reluctantly to the conclusion that Kennedy was probably assassinated as a result of a conspiracy. Before disbanding, it called upon the Justice Department to consider reopening the investigation, and had delivered a secret report detailing the fresh leads its work had developed. The result of that request was more than a decade of silence. More than anything, what has changed in the years since President Kennedy's assassination is our national consciousness. We have been through so much. There were, for example, the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr., Robert Kennedy, and Malcolm X. There were the assassination attempts on presidential candidate George Wallace and on Presidents Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan. We have lived through 9 horrifying years of the Vietnam War, the trauma of Watergate, the revelations during the 70s about the CIA, and more recently, the Iran-Contra affair. This extraordinary succession of events has ended our innocence. Looking back today with new information and new insights, it is possible to put together an informed historical speculation of what happened to President Kennedy and why. I believe that what happened at Dealey Plaza in Dallas on November 22, 1963, was a coup d'etat. I believe that it was instigated and planned long in advance by fanatical anti-communists in the United States intelligence community. That it was carried out, most likely, without official approval, by individuals in the CIA's covert operations apparatus and other extra-governmental collaborators. And I believe it was covered up by like-minded individuals in the FBI, the Secret Service, the Dallas Police Department, and the military. And that its purpose was to stop Kennedy from seeking detente with the Soviet Union and Cuba and ending the Cold War. A coup d'etat has been described as a sudden action by which an individual or group, usually employing limited violence, captures positions of government authority. And they do so without conforming to the formal requirements for changing office holders, as prescribed by the laws or constitution. A successful coup requires a number of elements. It requires extensive planning and preparation by the sponsors, those responsible for the coup. And it needs the collaboration of the Praetorian Guard, officials whose job is to protect the government, including the president. The third element is a diversionary cover-up afterwards. Then what's needed is the ratification of the assassination by the new government inheriting power. Finally, the dissemination of disinformation by major elements of the news media. If this concurrence of events has a familiar sound, it is because this is exactly what happened when John Kennedy was murdered. President Kennedy's foreign policy was reversed without conforming to the formal requirements for changing office holders as prescribed by the laws or constitution. And that is the very definition of a coup d'etat. This, then, was the major consequence of the assassination of John Kennedy and the real reason for it. Is all this plausible? It might not have seemed so 25 years ago. However, now that we know more about the CIA and its covert operations, the answer is a distinct yes. Assassination is precisely what the agency knows how to do and what it has done all over the world for policy ends. With the passage of time, we can see the enduring results of President Kennedy's assassination. The nation is still recovering from its tragic 9-year adventure in Vietnam. The CIA continues to run our foreign policy without any real control by either Congress or the President. Only now the agency stands far back in the shadows. It gives the appearance of distancing itself from the enterprise at hand, using private citizens and intermediaries to guarantee its insulation. Knowing all that we know now, the Justice Department still refuses to conduct an honest investigation into the most important political assassination of our time. Almost 3 decades after President Kennedy's murder, it may be too late. However, it is not too late for us to learn the lessons of history, to understand where we are now and who runs this country. If my story can help illuminate this for a younger generation who never knew John Kennedy, then it will have served its purpose.